Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. From reducing criminality to increasing educational and economic outcomes, early childhood programs are offered as an answer. But are they being oversold? We'll ask Alan Sanchez, the president of CHI St. Joseph's Children. St. Joe now runs the largest prenatal to three home visiting program in the country. Alan Sanchez is also a leading advocate for expanding state-funded early childhood programs by using small distributions from our $15 billion permanent fund. Alan's a good friend, and we welcome to the program. Alan Sanchez, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve, for inviting me.
Alan, later in the show, I want to find out why you want to use the permanent fund to expand early childhood education. But let's start with the question I raised at the top. Are we overselling these programs?
Now, I invite the listeners, Google James Heckman. He's a Nobel Prize winning economist from the University of Chicago, and he has pulled the data together. I think he makes the best argument, and it's not an oversell. The evidence is there.
So what's the argument? What, just in brief for listeners who aren't familiar
with it. Well, the argument is, this is the argument, okay? The brain architecture sets your whole future. And so if we intervene with children from prenatal to 3 years old with first-time parents, and imagine inviting them into your home, they're inviting you to journey with them and change culture, ideas about education. This is where the paradigm shift happens, Steve. And so if 90% of the brain development takes place in these first early years, we need to be on top of that. And we all know, the research shows that vocabulary builds reading. And this is determined by how many words a child speaks by the time they're 3 years old will determine when they get to kindergarten if they're arriving behind or on time. And if they have this vocabulary, that's what reading's about. They get to third grade, then they read at third grade level. And if they read at third grade level, they graduate. The statistics are there. If we turn this around early, and it has a larger implications from studies that we've seen. If you want to close down the expensive faucet downstream on all these social programs that we're putting hundreds of millions of dollars in, you got to go upstream. The more you spend on the playpen, the more you're going to save at the state pen. The proof is in the pudding. The research has been there. But I like to use this example, Steve. In New Mexico, we've got these beautiful potters. They make these wonderful pots, you know. And while they're making that fresh clay, and that's like the baby's brain to 2 years old. And that clay is soft and forming. They're creating, with positive interaction, 9,000 synapses per second. Think of that fresh clay. Yeah. And in New Mexico, we start poking holes in that clay before it dries.
So what are
those
holes?
Those are adverse childhood experiences.
What are those? Are the holes you're talking about?
Those are anything that cause toxic stress. Studies have shown that this toxic stress slows down the growth of synapses. So I'll give you examples. Homelessness, alcoholism, dysfunction in families, hunger. All these things cause stress, and that is slowing down the synapses growth in the brain.
So, but, families have experienced these things for a long time. Why all of a sudden do we need these programs
now? Well, because we're in an epidemic of them. Before, and you got to think about the human being, how we have evolved. You know, we evolved in clans and small groups, living in groups of 12 adults in one place. But the epidemic today is that our children are experiencing one or two adults interacting with them for the first 18 months of their life. But when people lived, even though they were poor, but if they lived in close proximity, then the grandparents were influencing. There comes the vocabulary, there comes the care, there comes the interaction. Aunts and uncles, older siblings, cousins, that doesn't exist the same today. And so to be in poverty today in New Mexico is very different than being in poverty 50 years ago. And, you know, we see, like, in the Albuquerque Journal, Dan had a calling for, you know, all your stories, who encouraged you to do great.
Right, I read that.
That was a different time, Steve, mm-hmm. when families were different. You look at the divorce rate, we don't have two adults always fully interacting with the baby. That's changed. And we have to accept the reality of our society.
Okay, so let's say, you know, what you say makes sense. And it does. It seems to make superficial sense. It seems to make brain science sense. It seems to make common sense.
Yeah.
But do these programs that you're talking about, home visiting and and pre-K. That's what you're talking about in terms of early
pre-K,
childhood.
High quality childcare, home visiting.
But what I want to ask you is, what's the evidence that these programs actually can do what you say in theory they can do? Because the theory is great, but do these programs work?
It, and they have been proven. So if you go to James Heckman, I began on that.
Yeah.
Google him. You're going to see that there's the non-cognitive skills also that are learned. Our epidemic of diabetes and heart disease comes from overweight. And overweight is really connected to something that happens to us before we're 3 years old. Being able to manage delayed gratification and self-control. Now, those are things that happen to babies very, very early. This is the setup of how you're going to behave in life. And so you see this then come out years later when they're 30, 40 years old. They're higher earners. They have less health risks. But here you and I are debating, but the debate is over out there in New Mexico. The people of New Mexico have already accepted this. If you look at the Brian Sandoroff polls, the people of New Mexico already accepted this. We don't need to debate this piece. And as an advocate,
yeah, I saw that Sandoroff poll is about 80%. 80% of New Mexicans think early childhood education is a good idea.
They get it. 80% say it's a good idea.
Before we go on to that, I want to – and actually, I did look at the Heckman article in preparation for this show. And I guess one of the most fascinating things he talks about is the Perry preschool program.
Yeah.
And what fascinated me about that is that the sort of so-called cognitive benefits – the IQ increases and achievement test scores weren't particularly great in that program. But the non-cognitive benefits, Woody Allen famously said, 80% of life is just showing up. And he's talking about, writing a screenplay.
Right.
Yeah. And that's really what the Perry preschool program showed. These kids stay in school longer. Mm-hmm. They persevere. They're persistent. They therefore earn more, et cetera, et cetera. Just what you're saying.
And something happens to the parents, too. I mean, they become engaged.
And I should mention, this was a randomized test. Yeah. So they took like 60 kids and put them in the preschool program, and they put 60 kids who didn't go into the program, and then they compared how they did in life for the next 40 years.
I mean, that's great. 40 years of proof to track this, and you see it. And, Americans, we think we're the only ones talking about this. If you go to Reggio Emilia, Italy, where they've been doing this for 50 years, fully funding early childhood, and it's unbelievable, the artists, the musicians, the engineers coming out of that community.
We actually do less than any other Western developed country.
Yeah. We do far less. Because, little children don't vote, Steve. And parents with young children, they don't vote. And so our legislators are catering, federally and locally, are catering to the older population who have the least interaction with the babies.
So let me mention, if you just tuned in, my name is Stephen Spitz, and this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. And I'm here with my very good friend, Alan Sanchez, who is the president of CHI, St. Joseph Children. And they run the largest home visiting program in the country. Get that. The largest home visiting program in the country is run right here in New Mexico. And Alan's also a major advocate for using the permanent fund to fund early childhood programs. And Alan, in preparation for the show, I kind of looked at what the LFC, the Legislative Finance Committee, was saying about early childhood programs. And they're a huge advocate for example, home visiting. They say evidence-based programs, so programs that have been shown through randomized tests work, and we should do that. They looked at pre-K programs, and they looked at like 10 pre-K programs, and they looked at the effect on third grade reading and math scores, and they said those programs have a major effect. So the LFC is solidly behind it. But then when I looked at what New Mexico is actually doing in terms of home visiting in pre-K, I mean, I was sort of shocked at the lack of early childhood.
Oh, yeah, the funds don't match the rhetoric. The funds don't match their words. And
how extensive are these programs that we're now?
Well, we have many of them, but we're only reaching, like, for home visiting, 4% of the population that's eligible. I mean, we can't live at 4%. Or of children, 4-year-olds for pre-K, we're only getting 25%. So if you see 4 children on the street, 3 of them aren't getting anything. Mm-hmm. And what's important there is I've heard some conservatives say, well, we should just target the need, okay? Steve, last year, 71% of the babies in New Mexico were born on Medicaid. They all have a need. I mean, that's a huge super majority has the need. But we have to, as an advocate and goodwill, I want to come with goodwill. I'm going to try and take the legislators at their word. And they're telling me that the debate is over about the need. They say they agree that there's a need. And they also say that they agree that the solution is these early childhood programs. That debate seems to be over in the public and in the legislature. But what makes it sound and hard to really believe it is that then they don't fund it. I mean, if you really believe in something, you fund it. If you think this is the solution to the violence that we're seeing, the economic situation, that we don't have any corporations, large corporations attracted to come to New Mexico, then we got to get to the truth. Then why don't you fund it? You know, there's a great slogan right now. I just love it because it makes me proud of New Mexico. New Mexico true. But I can't take credit for how high the altitude of the Sandias are or how deep the Carlsbad Caverns is or how white the white sands are. But I can take credit or take blame for our children being 49th in well-being. Steve, 5 years ago when I first came to this table with you, and our friendship has been around the children, which has been great, about working for this. 5 years ago when I came to this table, when Susana Martinez took office, we were ranked 44th in children's well-being from the Ann Casey Foundation's
the
Kids
Annie
Count.
Casey Foundation.
The Annie Casey Foundation Kids Count. We were 44th. We have moved in the 5 years while the debate's going on. We've moved there all the way down to 50th. Now we're 59th. And guess what? The land-grant permanent fund has grown by $5 billion while this debate began. My friends out there, folks, who doesn't get this anymore? Who doesn't get this? Everybody gets it. We have a need. We have a solution. And they won't go down this road. The conservatives have been for 5 years saying, well, we love this, but we don't like the funding source. Okay, my friends, show me another source. We've turned every rock over and you haven't come with any suggestions. Nobody has come with a substantial answer. The unmet need, the calculations I see are above $277 million. They may be greater, but a conservative number, I'm holding that. If we use 1% from the land-grant permanent fund, which is the second largest fund in the nation, it is the 33rd largest fund in the world. Now, try and swallow that. Make an image of a scale in your mind. One side, we're at the bottom of the barrel in children's well-being, and the other barrel, the gas and oil barrel that has fed that fund, is overflowing. Even with the price of oil dropping, the fund's grown by $1 billion this year.
So, Ellen, I'd like to just back up for 1 second and just get you to talk about what exactly home visiting is. Because, you know, we talk about early childhood programs as a generic thing. And I'd like you to also talk to us about what pre-K is. So
yeah, because
people...
I keep jumping to the big solution.
But people want to know. Yeah.
Home visiting is a very, very special type of process. Now, you can call it a program. But what it is going into the home. And people always say, oh, this will never work. Nobody wants you in their home. My friends, we're in 500 homes every week. So it's for what we run is first-time parents. There's different kinds of home visiting.
A firstborn program.
We run a firstborn program using two curriculums. One's called Firstborn. One's called a Partners for Healthy Baby from the State University of Florida. The curriculum is separate. That's a program. But the delivery is what we do. And we do it different and special. And we've done a replication model to help others do this. We go in once a week for 3 years.
No, it's voluntary, right? People
don't
have... Oh,
no, they joined this. Yeah, nobody's forced into this. And a matter of fact, CYFD's tried to force people in. And we said, no, they have to want to be part of this.
Okay.
But it's so attractive. And when the parents start sharing this with each other. So once a week for 3 years with a curriculum of health, well-being, and school readiness... appropriate for each week of life of that baby. And they become friends with that home visitor who comes to them, not to dictate or lecture, but to journey with them what the best evidence practices are and bring these options to them. But we also do referral. And that's why ours is a little different than the state-run programs. We have enhanced referral that accompanies this. The average family that comes into home visiting has 6 referral needs, either medical coverage, housing, food security. It's a number of things. And we immediately look at what's the need what do they qualify for, and meet those needs. And then you get their attention and they're ready for the curriculum.
So that sounds like a very expensive program. So how much does it cost?
It costs us $4,000 a family a year. All so right. When a family goes through our program, they've received well over $12,000 of services. But every penny well worth it, because this child's going to get to kindergarten. They're not going to be behind. You won't have the debate of holding them back in third grade, because they're going to be reading at third grade level.
And that's what these randomized studies of programs like yours have shown.
That's right? What it shows. And that's why we're tracking our children for the next 18 years, which is a very big investment,
so
but we want to prove
it. Let's talk a little bit about pre-K. Now, pre-K doesn't even exist here for three-year-olds.
No, no, we should have for three-year-olds and four-year-olds, but we don't
have
it.
The four-year-old program is primarily like a two-and-a-half-hour-a-day program.
Yeah, it's not even a full day. It's not
even
a full school program. Yeah, the LFC
says is inadequate. But what is pre-K? Because people may not know what it is.
It's not getting children in the desks earlier. It's getting the children building the skills that it takes for education. So they are working on vocabulary as they go along, but discipline, school readiness, and knowing their alphabet, knowing their numbers, knowing how to form lines, knowing how to pay attention, and we get a chance to identify any delays early, so that we can intervene with those. And so the children that participate in pre-K are way ahead of the game compared to those that just come in and drop in.
So how expensive are these programs?
Well, that program at the 2.5 hours a day is not very expensive. I mean,
it's something like $3,000.
Yeah, $3,000 a year.
Right.
$3,000 a year per child.
But the interesting thing to me is when I read, again, research on this, the cost of remediating with these kids is much higher than the cost of actually doing this to begin with when they're young.
Yeah.
And that's what the economic studies that you were talking about earlier that Heckman has done has shown.
So the
question is, why, if the legislators say they recognize this, and you've been through this with the legislators.
Well, we've been through it.
We have a $6 billion budget, right? Mm-hmm. So how come we can't fund it?
Well, we can't fund it, number one. A few years ago, we gave away part of the personal income tax. We gave away $500 million, okay? And then we continued to do corporate giveaways. And these corporate giveaways, which is unjust. I mean, when Walmart and big boxes, corporations walk away without paying any tax to our state, we're suffering.
Well, there's no proof that there's economic return
by giving away all those taxes. But because we've depleted that, we're barely getting by with what comes in for the budgets that's there. And then I want to remind people, you'll hear the legislature say, oh, we're spending all this new money on early childhood. No, you're not, because you haven't even repaired what was cut in 2008 from the crash. You know, they did those cuts. We're not even back to repair level of pre-2008. So it's not new money. It's trying to build back to where we were. New money will be once we pass that. And
well,
so,
like, for example, last year, there was, I think, $300 million in new money. And when I looked, I think, State home visiting got another $2 million. Pre-K got nothing additional. Right.
And the legislators, we doubled home visiting. $2 million? You know, 100% or a double increase of nothing is still nothing, Steve. It is a drop in the bucket. We as a society cannot accept this any longer. And the amazing thing is there's a solution, my friends. There's a solution. This land-grant permanent fund is dedicated to education. 83% of it is called the Permanent Common School Fund. And if we were to use 1% per year, the fund would still grow. Maybe not as fast, but it's still growing by $1 billion. We would be able to use $140 million a year on early childhood without raising one penny in taxes.
All right, so let me just mention, if you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to have on the program Alan Sanchez. And Alan runs the largest home visiting program in the country, and we're now talking about the issue that apparently is going to be brought up yet again this year by Alan at the legislature. We're talking about a 1% or 1.5% distribution of monies from the land-grant permanent fund to early childhood programs. And so let's talk about this distribution, and let's talk about the argument against it for a second.
Well,
because people, you know, the legislators say, well, look, you know, we're concerned about the fund. You're going to be taking money. If you took 1.5%, that'd be $225 million. Yeah. If you take 1%, it's like, all right, $140 million. And you're going to be taking this out. And we're concerned about that. But we're not just concerned about that. We're concerned about what's next. So, yeah, you come and raid the fund, and now Joe Blow comes. He has another idea, and, you know, there's that Willie Sutton quote, you know, I rob banks because that's where the money is. Well, people have their eye on the $15 billion permanent fund, and they want to keep it intact.
Well, you're correct when you say people have their eye of lining up to get money from this. Nobody else has introduced in the last 5 years a constitutional amendment to change the distribution to another issue. Now, let me explain this part. First of all, I want to thank, because he really takes a lot of credit, is Senator Michael Padilla, who's the sponsor of the legislation. Okay.
Okay.
Now, it takes a constitutional amendment because the land-grant permanent fund is governed by the Constitution. That means the people of New Mexico get to make the decision about how the formula distributing that money. There's 22 beneficiaries. And what we're proposing would only take money from the portion that's called the common schools. That's 83%, the largest piece of it, because it can only be spent on education. Senator Papin one day asked me, well, Alan, what if we want to use that money to pay Texas for water? Well, I'm sorry, you can't. You'd have to have another constitutional amendment to do that. This money is earmarked for education. We're not out asking for something extraordinary. We're asking for it to serve what it was intended for. Now, we've had constitutional amendments in the past to change the distribution. When this began, it was only funding first grade to eighth grade. And that's in 1910 when the fund was created. And then when we became a state in 1912. But when eighth grade to 12th, ninth to 12th became common, they raised it to include that. When kindergarten became common, it was raised to include that. Well, now science tells us education begins with the pre-K and these early programs. So it won't hurt any of the beneficiaries. As a matter of fact, the other beneficiaries will have an increase of a draw from their portion, like school for the blind, school for the deaf.
Why would they have an increase?
Because you're going to change the distribution of the entire fund, okay? And then that goes to the each group that it's earmarked for.
I see.
So that's an important piece.
If you raise it from 5 to 6%, everybody gets it.
So right now, it's the distribution. Okay, the fund. The fund is $15 billion plus. That's huge. Second largest fund in the nation. If we were to take 1% out of this, the fund would still double by 2032.
Where are you getting that
from? The State Investment Council. The State Investment Council says that it is targeted to double in 2027.
Based on what kind of increases in the fund?
In the fund,
like it has been growing at 6 or 7% per year. So
well, it grows.
Are they
it grows
assuming?
By. Let me first back up. I want to share this part, and we'll get to the distribution amount and the income. The fund is scheduled to double by 2027.
But you can't schedule a fund to double.
It either doubles
or it doesn't double
based on what it's invested in. They say it's going to double.
Okay.
At the rate.
Okay.
So let's back up now. Talk about the rate.
Right.
It grows by two sources. It's not like an endowment of any foundation. And they like to compare it to foundations, but it's not like any foundation because it grows by two sources. One, by investment in the stock market. And that usually is about 7%. And then it grows by another 4% by gas and oil. Now, that's down a little now. But surprise, it's still grown by $1 billion even with gas and oil being low because it has two sources of revenue.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I looked. I think last year, $800 million came in from gas and oil, and less than that went out. So actually,
the fund
actually had a net increase over distribution.
Yeah. And so, Steve, this fund grows by two sources. In the last 10 years, including the 2008 crash, it has had an average of income of 11%. 11% annually for 10 years each year. That's huge. And guess what? You know, the red herrings from the critics, from the conservatives, they say, now, they had two doomsday scenarios, and they both have come and gone. One, what happens if the stock market crashes? Well, that happened, and that came and went, and the fund continued to grow. It bounced right back. Second doomsday scenario, what happens if the price of oil drops out the bottom? That's happened, and the fund is still growing because it is robust. It's huge. It has two sources of revenue. 1% more out of it won't kill us. Now, this is what I want all New Mexicans to listen to.
In other words, you take 1% out for additional distributions, the fund is going to continue to grow.
Oh, it's going to continue to grow.
And the fund is there for education.
It's there for education. So we get fed from the Legislative Finance Committee, very important. They come out and say, well, the fund has 11% of growth, of money, new money coming in, okay, from investment and from the gas and oil revenues. But then they only like to talk about the 7% that comes from investment. And then so that's an annual growth, okay? Let's do the math. 7% a year growing. By law, the distribution right now is 5.5. But it's not 5.5 because they're using a 5-year rolling average. It's really 4.4. And that's where they're misleading people when they say, we only get 7% from the investment and we're spending 5.5. You're not.
So Let me talk about some of the other things I've heard about not doing this, some of the other arguments. And one of them is, you know, all this money is going to come in, like make it $140 million or make it $220 million, depending on what passes. Mm-hmm. And it's going to just overwhelm the system. I mean, New Mexico isn't ready for it. We don't have the workers. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the learned people that are going to go out and administer it. And by the way, how is it going to be divided up? We don't know how it's going to be divided up, who's going to get it, whether it's going to be a sensible division. We don't know any of these things, and that's not part of what you propose. So,
Steven,
you know, there are all these unknowns.
If we were going to base any legislation on the argument you just said there, we would never attempt anything. We would never attempt anything, okay? There is a plan. The plan is let's fully fund what we already have. If we just funded a pre-K, we would spend all of it there. Or if we fully funded assisted child care to high-quality centers, we would spend it all there. If we fully funded home visiting, we'd spend half of it there. We have great models in place. We've proven overnight 500 families.
So you can fully fund all these things, but what are you going to – how would it be funded?
Okay, let's go first. First, we're trying to pass a constitutional amendment that makes it legal to disperse the money for this. That's what the constitutional amendment is. Then there would have to be accompanying legislation that comes afterwards. And the legislators say, oh, I'm afraid, you know, what's going to happen to this money? Well, don't be afraid. You're the one that's going to make the decision of the appropriations.
So the legislature
has to appropriate
it. I see.
The money is made available. It's just like a tax. This is a tiny population, and we're the fourth largest oil producer. And most of that is on government land. We can do this. And all that's stopping us is a handful of people.
Let me ask you about that, because we're coming to the end of the show. What do you really think is going to happen? I mean, do you really think we're going to get early childhood passed now or ever?
The need is not going away. The need's there. The evidence is there that this is the solution. The fund is only getting bigger, and I'm not going away. The advocates are not going away until this happens.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank so much my guest and my friend, Alan Sanchez. I would also like to thank my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Chebecki. My name is Steven Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available on iTunes. Search Steven Spitz. Archives of my past shows are available at stevenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.